Hi, Rebecca Murray here. Wanted to give you a quick introduction for the Sonic Leadership Tool Guide audio briefing. I used a program called Notebook LM, a Google product you may be familiar. I uploaded my keynote as well as the Sonic Leadership Coaching Guide and asked it to pull highlights from both together in an audio file just for you. So I hope that you can use this recording, share it with your team, and it will inspire people to take notice of their voice when it comes to vocal influence. Please don't hesitate to reach out. I would love to hear your voice by phone, on Zoom, or in person. Until then, please enjoy the Sonic Leadership Audio Briefing.
So before you even finish saying the word hello, the people sitting across the table have actually already made a subconscious decision about your leadership potential.
Right. Yeah. It happens incredibly fast.
And it has absolutely nothing to do with like your resume or how sharp your talking points are, or even the vocabulary you just used.
Yeah. We like to think we're being completely objective, right? Like we're just evaluating the data.
Exactly. But it's entirely about the pitch, the rhythm, and just the literal physical sound waves hitting their ears.
It is. I mean, long before the actual data registers in our brains, we are actively filtering everything through the raw acoustic delivery of the messenger's voice.
Which is wild. And that is exactly what we are exploring today. We are doing a deep dive into the Sound of Influence keynote and the Sonic Leadership Coaching Guide, both by Rebecca P. Murray.
Two really fantastic sources, yeah.
They really are. And our mission for this deep dive is to, you know, understand how the sound of our voice shapes our influence before we even finish a sentence.
Right. And more importantly, how you can actually master those vocal signals, both for yourself and when you're coaching others.
So if you are listening right now, whether you are leading a virtual meeting, pitching a big idea, or literally just leaving a voicemail, your voice is doing so much heavy lifting that you probably don't even realize.
Oh, absolutely. It's working overtime.
So let's just dive right into the biology of it.
Mm.
Because if the voice is this powerful tool, we have to look at just how fast it does its job.
Yeah. And to understand that, you really have to look at the brain's processing speed. The materials focus heavily on what they call the 100 millisecond impression.
Wait, 100 milliseconds. That's practically instantaneous.
It is. I mean, just a fraction of a second. But that is all it takes for the listener's brain to evaluate an incoming voice and like assign it a credibility score.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the biological breakdown here is fascinating. The listener's brain is essentially dividing the labor of listening, right?
Exactly. So your left brain is basically acting as a decoder for the actual words.
Like the literal vocabulary and syntax.
Right. What is actually being said. But at the exact same time, the right side of the brain is running this entirely separate diagnostic on how that sentence is being delivered.
So it's scanning the tone, the musicality, the rhythm, like what linguists call prosody.
You got it. And that right brain scan carries just an enormous amount of weight because, you know, historically, humans evolved to interpret the tone of a sound way before we developed complex vocabulary.
Like reacting to an aggressive growl or a soothing hum.
Right, exactly. That evolutionary wiring is still running the show today. So on average, they say about 60% of the meaning we take away from a conversation comes from the literal words.
Meaning a massive 40% comes entirely from vocal delivery.
Yeah. And well, if we're talking about virtual environments like a Zoom call or whatever, that delivery actually jumps up to carrying over 50% of the total meaning.
That makes sense. Because you lose so much body language when you're just a tiny box on a screen.
Exactly. The voice becomes the primary tether holding their attention. And if there is a clash between the words and the tone,
like sarcasm, right?
Perfect example. If you say, oh, I love that, but your tone is totally flat. The brain almost universally believes the tone. It carries about 5 times more influence than the actual words.
Wow. Okay, so thinking about this 100 millisecond window, it operates a lot like a website's load time.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Like if you click a link and the page just stalls on a blank white screen, you don't sit there analyzing the invisible code. You just click away.
Yeah, you're gone. You bounce.
So if a voice doesn't sound confident instantly, does our brain just subtly click away from the actual substance of their ideas?
That is exactly what happens. Vocal influence isn't just about how a voice is produced. It's heavily about how it is received by that rapid-fire brain.
Okay, so since our right brain is judging voices at lightning speed, what is it actually scanning for?
Well, unfortunately, it's often relying on some pretty deeply ingrained historical biases, particularly when it comes to pitch.
Right, the pitch paradox. Let's get into this, because this blew my mind. Culturally, we associate a lower vocal pitch with authority and dominance, right?
Yes, and conversely, a higher pitch is usually linked to, like, likability and warmth.
But also things like inexperience or being submissive.
Exactly. And the history behind how this specific double standard got so entrenched is just fascinating. It goes straight back to the 1920s.
The early days of radio.
Right. When early radio stations first started broadcasting, the technology was, well, incredibly primitive.
They used those old carbon microphones, right?
Yeah, carbon microphones and transmitters with super limited bandwidth. And mechanically, they physically compressed the audio signals. They literally cut out the higher frequencies.
Because the equipment just couldn't process those rapid sound waves.
Exactly. And that mechanical limitation had a profound social impact. Voices that naturally sat in a higher register.
Which it disproportionately meant female voices.
Right. Those voices were badly distorted by the equipment. It stripped away the higher frequency consonant sounds, leaving those higher voices sounding kind of shrill or harsh or muffled.
I read that listeners actually wrote in to complain that higher voices were unintelligible.
They did. And it led to this massive documented 100-to-1 listener preference for male voices over female voices in early broadcasting.
Okay, I have to push back on this for a second. Wait, so are we actually biologically wired to respect lower voices? Or are we just suffering from a 100-year-old bad tech hangover from 1920s radio?
That is the million-dollar question. What's fascinating here is that it's largely the tech hangover. We are absolutely punishing people today for an unexamined bias.
Like, we're essentially walking into modern boardrooms carrying the acoustic baggage of faulty 1920s microphones.
We really are. We've spent a century consuming media, you know, news broadcasts, institutional messaging, all delivered by a very specific low-resonant vocal archetype.
So anyone with a naturally higher pitch is stepping up to the mic, and the listener's brain is misinterpreting their natural sound as a lack of leadership readiness.
Exactly. It puts them at an immediate, unfair disadvantage.
Which naturally brings us to the concept of voice equity. Because if historical biases are silencing certain voices, how do we fix the environment so everyone actually gets heard?
Right. Voice equity is framed in the guide as equal opportunity for contribution. Or EOC.
It's not just about having a seat at the table.
No, not at all. It's about not being talked over or subconsciously dismissed. And a huge part of this is physical. It's about acoustic equity.
The actual physics of the room.
Yes. Think about your standard corporate boardroom. Big glass walls, hard surfaces. These rooms are notorious acoustic filters.
They naturally amplify lower, louder voices, so they boom and resonate.
Right, while completely absorbing or scattering softer, higher-pitched voices.
We see this all the time in hybrid meetings. If the room is actively absorbing someone's higher voice, their only option is to, like, push, to force it.
And that creates a whole new problem. Yeah. If someone is forced to speak louder, their vocal cords tighten, their pitch naturally rises even further, and they start to sound strained.
Or anxious. And then the listener's brain thinks, oh, they're nervous, which subtly chips away at their credibility.
Exactly. Plus, you have to consider accessibility. Roughly 20% of adults have some degree of hearing loss, mostly in higher frequencies. So acoustic equity isn't just nice to have, it's a functional necessity.
It makes me think of an analogy. We wouldn't invite someone to a meeting and make the room physically inaccessible, right? Like, we build wheelchair ramps.
Of course.
So why do we accept acoustic environments that force people to physically strain their voices just to be heard? It's wild.
It really is. And the guide makes it clear that leaders must actively manage the room.
So establishing norms for brief contributions, rotating who facilitates.
And universally using microphones whenever they're available. Even if someone says, oh, I have a loud voice, I don't need a mic.
Right. Fix the room. So ideas rise on merit, not on physical lung capacity. Okay, so once we've leveled the playing field and fixed the room acoustics, how do we actually optimize our own vocal delivery?
That is where we get into the mechanics. The guide introduces this framework called the vocal influence triad.
Let's break this down because it gives us a way to understand the instrument without getting bogged down in, you know, heavy medical jargon. So the first pillar is power.
Right. Power is all about breath support. The voice is an acoustic instrument, and it's fueled by air leaving the lungs.
So if you're slouched over your laptop, your diaphragm is compressed, and you just physically can't take in enough air.
Exactly. And weak breath support leads to some really distracting habits. People start trailing off at the ends of sentences or mumbling.
Where they drop into that dreaded vocal fry.
Oh, yeah. Vocal fry, that creaky popping sound, it literally happens because the lungs run out of air, but the speaker keeps forcing words out.
Okay, so power is the breath. The second pillar of the triad is meaning.
Meaning is the prosody, the music of the voice, the pitch, rhythm, tone.
Right. And a complete lack of meaning gives you a monotone delivery, like a robot.
Yeah, which tells the listener that nothing you're saying is actually important. But the opposite extreme is also an issue, like an overabundance of prosody.
Oh, like a sing-song pattern or upspeak?
Yes, upspeak is so common. It's when you unconsciously raise your pitch at the very end of a declarative sentence.
Like, we need the budget finalized by Friday.
Exactly. It mechanically turns a directive into a question. It completely drains the authority out of the statement.
Makes total sense. And then the third pillar is shaping.
Right. Shaping is articulation. How your mouth, lips, tongue, and jaw physically carve the raw sound into distinct words.
So if you're nervous and rushing, your jaw tightens, your mouth doesn't open fully, and words just mush together.
Exactly. Rushed shaping destroys clarity.
So what does this all mean when we put it together? Because I like to compare the triad to a high-end stereo system.
Oh, I like that. How so?
Well, power is the amplifier plugged into the wall, right? Providing the raw energy. Shaping represents the high-definition speakers keeping everything crisp. And meaning is the equalizer board, adding the emotion and highlighting the important parts.
That is a perfect analogy. And when those three work together, the voice becomes grounded. It's easy to follow.
And it moves us away from giving people terrible, vague advice like, hey, just sound more confident.
Ugh, yes, sound more confident is unactionable. But telling someone to sit up, engage their breath, and drive their volume through the end of the sentence, that's a mechanical adjustment they can actually do.
Which is so crucial when we shift into tactical coaching. Because giving feedback on someone's voice is incredibly sensitive territory. It feels as personal as giving feedback on someone's face.
It really does. People's voices are so tied to their identity. You have to be so careful not to trigger a defensive fight or flight response.
Right. So how do we make sure we aren't just projecting our own biases onto them?
Well, the rule for coaching here is that feedback must be kind and incredibly specific. You have to audit yourself first. Ask yourself, is this a real communication issue, like severe mumbling, or just my own cultural preference for a deep executive voice?
Start with observation, not judgment.
Exactly. And the data here is really interesting. Leaders, especially women, are rarely penalized for being assertive, but they are heavily penalized for the absence of warmth.
So if you deliver feedback coldly, their brain just rejects it.
Right. So instead of saying something vague and judgmental, like, you sounded really unsure of yourself in there.
Which feels like an attack on their character.
Yes. You isolate the mechanic. You say, when presenting the proposal, I noticed your pitch rose at the end of several sentences, which sounded uncertain. Let's talk about how to adjust pitch to sound more definitive.
That is so much better.
Yeah.
It links the mechanic to the perception without attacking their actual confidence.
Yeah.
And the guide has this ultimate opening script that I just love.
Oh, the one for initiating the broader conversation.
Yeah. It goes something like, I'd love to chat about the signal your voice sometimes sends in our meetings. Not because there's anything wrong with it, but because I want to make sure the sound of your voice reflects the authority and expertise you clearly have.
It's brilliant. It instantly puts you on the same side of the table as them. The goal is just making sure their expertise is recognized.
It frames it as a tool that just needs a tune-up. Okay, so we know how to coach others fairly, but what can you, the listener, do right now to optimize your own vocal footprint?
There are some great, highly actionable tips in the guide, like tuning the instrument before a big meeting.
Literally tuning it. How do we do that?
Well, before you walk into the room, take a deep breath, engage your diaphragm, and just hum. Start at a high pitch and slide down to a low pitch.
Like,
Exactly. As you slide down, you'll feel a physical vibration in your chest. That is your optimal grounded speaking register.
So locking into that keeps you from starting the meeting with a tight, nervous, high-pitched greeting.
Right. It grounds you immediately.
And another tip is regarding your voicemail, which is essentially like 12 seconds of digital real estate.
Yes. Treat your outgoing voicemail like a priority. state your name slowly and warmly. It's often the very first time someone hears your voice. And that level of deliberate curation ties into the final and perhaps most profound practical tip in the sources, how you say your own name.
The way you introduce yourself is the ultimate acoustic window into your self-worth.
The mechanical advice here is to state your name slowly. You place a slight downward inflection on the final syllable to signal absolute certainty, and you place a distinct, deliberate pause between your first and last name. Like, you do not rush past it.
Because by inserting that pause and controlling that downward inflection, you are taking up temporal space.
You're claiming time.
Yes. You're signaling to the listener's primal brain that you value yourself enough to claim that time, which subconsciously instructs their brain to value you as well.
So, tracing the whole path we've taken today, we started with the neurology of the 100 millisecond judgment and the right brain's dominance over tone. We looked at the evolutionary roots of the pitch paradox and the historical reality of how early technology sidelined higher frequency voices.
The 1920s radio effect.
Right. We examined the physics of acoustic equity in modern physical spaces, and we broke down the mechanics of the vocal influence triad power, meaning, and shaping.
And the overarching philosophy of all this material is that sonic leadership is not about forcing everyone to adopt a deep, booming, homogenous sound.
It's not about turning everyone into a 1930s radio announcer.
Exactly. It is about building profound mechanical awareness. It's about expanding the range of your instrument and optimizing your influence without erasing the biological uniqueness of your specific voice.
Before we wrap up, the sources raise one final, highly provocative thought regarding the future of this space.
Because as we accelerate into this era of AI-generated speech and flawless voice cloning, we really have to ask ourselves a tough question.
Are we just going to unknowingly program all of our historical biases right into the code?
Exactly. Like, will the machines of the future only respect low authoritative pitches because that's what the historical data prefers? Or will we actually use the blank slate of this new technology to finally break the bias trap?
We have a chance to redefine what diverse, true vocal authority actually sounds like.
We really do. So the next time you step up to pitch an idea or you click unmute on a virtual call, just remember, your resume only got you the invitation. The physical sound waves of your voice are doing the heavy lifting. So take a breath, find your resonance, and own your 100 milliseconds. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.